WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
As the year ends, experts of all sorts are trying to sum up the changes of the century. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking, of course, about changes in our language.
I wonder how much of the history of the century you could tell just through the suffixes that have been in vogue from one decade to the next. Think what you'd have to cover to trace the development of inn, for example, the drive-ins of the early days of the automobile, the sit-ins of the civil rights movement, the be-ins and love-ins of the hippies, the teach-ins of the anti-war movement. There's the ville of the 40s in words like Ennsville and Splitsville and Palookaville, which was succeeded in the late 50s by the nick of beatnik, neatnik, and the rest. There's the gate of travel gate and Monica gate, and the size of dancer size, jazzer size, and all the other fitness crazes. There's .com. And then there's thon. I was thinking about this one the other day when they held the walkathon at my daughter's school. Sophie did 17 laps, and all her sponsors duly received a notice of how much they owed toward the purchase of new playground equipment. It's a common ritual these days. The suffix thon is having a monster decade. We have walkathons, bowlathons, swimathons, bikeathons, and danceathons. Christian radio stations have praiseathons. And the library of the University of North Texas recently held a barcode-a-thon to convert its books to an automated system. I would have figured that walk-a-thon and the others were pretty recent inventions. But in fact, the thon business goes back quite a ways. It all started with marathon, of course, which entered English in 1896 when the first modern Olympics were held. Marathon was originally the name of a place 26 miles from Athens where a famous battle was fought. But nobody thought of stripping the thon off the end of the word until the 1920s. That was an era obsessed with watching people do things for abnormal lengths of time. The public flocked to six-day bicycle races and made a hero of Alvin Shipwreck Kelly, who set a record in 1929 by sitting on top of a flagpole in Atlantic City for 49 days. And then there were the dance marathons, which people started to call dance-a-thons for short. Most of us remember these now from the 1969 movie They Shoot Horses, Don't They? Couples would dance for days or weeks on end for small cash prizes, with dancers occasionally collapsing or dropping dead on the dance floor. Some states tried to discourage these ordeals by passing laws that prohibited dancing for more than 8 hours on end. To get around these restrictions, the promoters started holding competitions where dancers were allowed to walk around for brief rest periods. They billed these as walkathons, since walking contests had no time limit. Those early dance-a-thons and walkathons were simply spectacles or publicity stunts. The connection between the suffix thon and charity had to await the introduction of television. Broadcast TV was still looking for its voice back in 1949 when NBC had the idea of holding the first telethon on behalf of the Damon Runyon Cancer Fund. The host was Milton Berle, TV's first big star. He remained on stage for 16 hours straight, apart from brief visits to his dressing room to shave and change his shirt. A stage full of models and showgirls handled the phones, with planer operators taking calls backstage. One of Uncle Milty's guests on that occasion was a young comedian named Jerry Lewis. 17 years later, he would bring the telethon to its highest form of expression. It was his great insight that the host of the telethon must not shave or change his shirt. Over the course of the Labor Day weekend, the entire country could watch Jerry grow increasingly rumpled and haggard as he draped himself around a series of affecting little kids on crutches, a tableau that ultimately enriched the English language with the phrase poster child. The whole production was a clear improvement over the dance-a-thons of the 1920s. It gratified the same morbid voyeurism, but now you came away from it feeling edified. The telethon gave rise to a host of charitable events like pledge-a-thons and call-a-thons, though nothing has ever surpassed the Jerry Lewis telethons for sheer, pathetic spectacle. But starting in the 80s, thon took another turn which united both its earlier senses of sustained physical activity and charitable giving. Where young people used to raise money for a good cause by holding bake sales or car washes, now they get friends and relatives to pledge money in return for their performing some strenuous exercise to the point of near collapse. It's true that people from the 20s or 50s might have had trouble understanding what one has to do with the other. But it's a natural fit for an age that thinks of running 5 kilometers as a form of spiritual exercise, and all the more so if it's dedicated to a worthy cause. That's why even well-established road races and competitions have come on board, each of them consecrating itself to a popular disease. There's something about all these modern walkathons and bike-a-thons that recalls the early Middle Ages, when you could acquire indulgences by paying other people to say masses or make pilgrimages on your behalf. That practice was finally discontinued when the church decided it rested on dubious theological grounds. But why not? It seems a perfect system for everybody. Or at least, that's how it felt when the walkathon at the San Francisco school was over. The school had raised little money, the kids were glowing with self-satisfied exhaustion. And we sponsors had the moral gratification of knowing that our donations were purely selfless and disinterested. After all, our cars were still dirty.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center.